Can't wait.
It was a good game. Both teams play hard.
With no regard for human life.
To all the non-believers, all we hear is about their defense. They can't stop a nosebleed.
I'm a man. I'm 40.
I got man hits like I was Rod Carew.
Yeah. Can't wait.
What happened offensively in that period?
Turnovers.
What about on the defensive end? They had their most productive quarter. What'd you see there?
Turnovers. Not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, not seven.
Not the game that I go out there and die for.
This is grown man B.I.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player.
Can't wait.
Relax and take notes.
Hello there. You are listening to Can't Wait. I'm Rusty Boulay Stevenson, and I am joined by both Milner brothers Matt.
Hello.
And Tim.
Hello.
And we're here today. We're going to talk to you about a few different things, but first up is cheating in sports. I don't know if you've heard, but Tom Brady was recently implicated, probably, as to having deflated footballs or encouraging others to deflate footballs for him. And we're going to take a look at that. We're going to take a look at the Wells report and what the investigation found, which was over 240 pages of nothing but Tom Brady being kind of made implicated in this matter.
And, you know, actually, I thought that it was a remarkable document just in terms of the depths to which they went to try to demonstrate the probability that this occurred in the absence of the smoking gun that Brady and his agent are now, you know, pointing is missing and has cast, you know, a shadow over the whole investigation. But even in the absence of that, they basically marshaled every other piece of scientific evidence that one could possibly marshal in support of the position that more probably than not, there was an intentional act of doctoring that occurred that certainly involved at least a couple of the equipment personnel. And I think that though they use the terminology more probable than not, because that's just kind of the standard within these NFL investigations, that is the standard burden of proof to demonstrate a violation. I think that, in my opinion, I would go much further than saying that it's more probable than not that Brady was involved. I think it's a near certainty that he was at least complicit in it.
Right. The scientific testing gets as thorough as testing how long, if you have a minute and 40 seconds in a bathroom, how long
with a needle.
With a needle and a bag of footballs, you know, the scientific testing on exactly how long that should take.
Right.
And how much they deflate when they're in the cold.
Exactly how much they deflate. Yeah,
I mean, they really did try to take it into account everything, I felt like. And I really appreciated that they seemed to be so thorough. But, I mean, what you're getting at, Matt, is they make it sound like 51% probability that he did it. When we all three read the report, I don't think any of us come away thinking it was 51% that he probably did it. It's probably more like 80 or 85%, even higher.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that clearly Brady has the lowest degree of connection to the evidence, because at the end of the day, most of the evidence they have on Brady is through the text messages of the two equipment and locker room individuals involved, Jim McNally and John Jastrzemski. But the problem with that is that the reason they don't have that smoking gun text or call from Brady is that Brady refused to turn over that information. And for him to get up on his high horse and his agent now and claim that this whole thing was, you know, a witch hunt, and that they've been unfairly prosecuted, that there's no proof, and yet hold on to the key evidence. And the phone records that are available make it very clear that Brady had a number of conversations with Jastrzemski during the period of time after the story broke and the investigation started, and they had an unusually high number of conversations, at least compared to their past records. And the idea that he wants to sort of plead ignorance and pretend like he has no knowledge or connection of any of this going on,
yeah,
it's crazy.
And for me, one of the takeaways, especially regarding his involvement, was that when I picture the Patriots of this past decade and I think about their role as really, in wrestling terms, the top heel in the promotion, the biggest villain,
right,
that when I thought about this instance, especially in relation to the videotaping scandal of a few years back, I think of this well-orchestrated, devious act. And then you read through these text messages, and the language is pretty crude.
Right.
You see these kind of, you know, flippant texts about Tom Brady being a jerk to these guys.
And a royal jerk. Football.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you said, a royal jerk about exactly how these footballs are deflated. They chronicle sort of week to week throughout the season different issues that Brady took with the footballs. And the two equipment guys, you know, texting together about, oh, man, Brady's really going to be on you about that one. Or wait till you see how Brady reacts this time.
Let's see, he's going to get watermelons.
Right? Yeah.
Right. He's going to get watermelons blown up and try to throw those, a rugby ball.
Right. Yeah. I also, another one of my favorite little tidbits, and part of what I enjoyed so much about reading this was the glimpse inside the way that a locker room works and the way mm-hmm. that the process works of getting these balls ready and how the officials interact with all of it. It's a part of football that you never think about or have any insight into. Mm-hmm. But there's one reference in the report to, an instance where Jastrzemski is invited into the quarterback room. But they describe it as it's essentially Tom Brady's office. And I really yeah. loved envisioning, you know, Tom Brady like clocking in like any other regular Joe who goes yeah. to their office job. And, you know, it just so happens that his office job, like in between breaking down film on his laptop and at his desk, is that he goes out and he, you know, gets hit by people. But still, I liked the mundaneness of these little details in there that helped to sort of peel back the curtain a little bit. Of the process that goes on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. In fact, Jastrzemski had never been in that room, like in his 20 years or whatever, working for the New England Patriots. That was
right.
his one time of going. There are so many pieces that just lead to this circumstantial evidence, right, that just absolutely implicates Tom right. Brady. I mean, there are so many that he helped with Peyton Manning to change the rule in 2006 for who handled the footballs before the game, right?
Right.
And so I mean, and as I've seen in like Slate magazine and a few other places have reported, the fumbles, and that's what seems to be maybe the biggest issue, is that fumbles for the Patriots fell off the table as soon as that happened in 2006. After that, the Patriots all at once stopped fumbling the football. And you have to think that has had an effect over these years, over these 9 years now of the Patriots' dominance and mm-hmm. being the bad guys. What do you guys think? I mean, how do you take it?
Well, I think that the fumbling analysis that was I first saw it in Slate as well, but to be honest, I don't recall who was the one who was breaking down the data. But it's really compelling stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the areas where I think it's very challenging for us to be able to ascertain what it means is that regardless of whether you think that they're devious cheaters or not, there's no question that the Patriots have been on the cutting edge within the NFL over the past decade in terms of embracing a lot of different techniques and strategies that have given them a competitive advantage even within the confines of the rules. So I'm willing to accept that for the fumbling statistics, that it's possible that it's not just a reflection of the fact that they have been cheating and that the balls have always been underinflated, but that at a minimum, to the extent that they've been able to control the inflation point within the acceptable range, that they have always pushed for those balls to be on the lowest possible deflation rate. And that even something like that, if there are other organizations that haven't embraced that to the same extent, and you saw even with the Colts that you know, the Colts wanted the ball to be
right around 13. Yeah. And that gets into an interesting conversation, you know, of how much this does vary team to team, that it was clear to Walt Anderson, the referee of that game, in the room before the game, that it definitely looked like the Colts were targeting 13 PSI, mm-hmm. and it definitely looked like the Pats were targeting 12.5 PSI. Of course, the issue here is that when those balls eventually made it to the field, they were no longer at 12.5 PSI. But I wonder how much that does vary team to team. If they're aware of, you know, the Patriots are always going for this, we're going to counter by going for this. And it gets into a whole level of gamesmanship well off the field that most of us were previously not really aware of.
Yeah, it's true.
No, certainly not talking about it on a Sunday afternoon with my buddies.
No.
About how inflated footballs are.
Wonder what PSI the Colts are going to come out with today. You know, it's right. It's not the conversation we're used to having.
Yeah, but I think that the Patriots at a certain point have invited this scrutiny on themselves just by virtue of the fact that this is not their first time that they've been wrapped up in some kind of unfair competition allegation. And you referred earlier to the taped practices that happened, mm-hmm. I guess, almost a decade ago now.
Yeah.
But, you know, more earlier on in their Super Bowl run. And, you know, there's no question that whether we're talking about getting a competitive advantage in terms of an insight into the other team's strategy, or getting a competitive advantage that allows you to manipulate the equipment and tools of the game, that even if Belichick was not implicated in the Wells report, and there's no evidence that he had knowledge, it certainly feels like they've created a culture of hyper-competitiveness that perhaps created an environment where it's not entirely surprising that Brady and others would take it upon themselves to skirt the rules where it's available to them.
Absolutely. I think that does have a trickle-down effect. You see that when Belichick is doing things like that just this past season with the formations that really sort
right.
of pushed the boundaries of what was legal and what wasn't in terms of the way he had the offensive line come out.
And it's illegal now, by the way.
Right. And it's illegal now.
Yeah.
And so I think that when you see that, you know, that a coach, a whole front office that is looking for a competitive edge, pushing the boundaries, and, you know, maybe not necessarily cheating, but they're getting so close to it that attitude trickles down.
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case with the New England Patriots. And, you know, I don't think a lot of times people are calling this sour grapes because they are the heel of the NFL, because mm-hmm. they've been so successful that it's easy for other parts of the country to root against them. But nobody's saying that Duke cheated in basketball. No, mm-hmm. maybe the Yankees a little bit, you get that because of A-Rod or whatever, but nobody's saying that the Yankees are good because they cheat all the time. Nobody's saying that. The only organization they're pointing at is the New England Patriots, the only heel organization, if we continue to use that terminology. And so to me, it's way more than sour grapes, especially when you see this report. It's hard to believe that somebody could care so much, and to be in Tom Brady's spot, to be that successful, he cares about the nuances that we never, never, ever see, like
yeah.
the PSI of a football. And to think that all at once he just doesn't know, and that's what he claimed, right? He claimed to not know what the limits were, even though he was influential in a rule that let teams set it up.
Right.
He says he didn't know. I mean,
yeah.
that just doesn't sit right with you. It just doesn't. And the whole organization, we have seen this time and again. I'm not the biggest football fan, but this is exactly what we continue to see from this organization. And I do think that it's a little bit of the hyper-masculinity. I think this is almost going to be a theme for today's show, is that's part of what's going on there, is these guys have to be the absolute best. Tom Brady was already the best quarterback. He was already the alpha male in the NFL, and that's not enough for him. He's got to go above and beyond that to cheating, to deflating footballs.
Yeah. You know, at the time that we're recording this, Goodell has not announced what the consequences will be yet, but what do you guys think? Do you think that we're looking at a 1 or 2 game suspension? Do you think that they'll come down any harder than that?
Go ahead, Tim. What do you think?
You know, Goodell hasn't exactly set a precedent for harsh penalties in the past couple of years.
Right.
So it's hard for me to imagine that it's going to be severe. Based on, you know, earlier precedents, you know, obviously we don't have anything quite like this scandal.
Right.
It's a little different when you look at other suspensions. It's harder to find a parallel. I find myself gravitating towards something like 5 games.
Wow.
Do you think that, and this isn't specific to football, I suppose, do you think that when the league is weighing what the consequence should be, should they take into account the high-profile nature of Tom Brady's position and the fact that it happened, you know, during their postseason run in a year in which they ultimately won the Super Bowl? Do you think that the consequence should be more severe for Tom Brady than it would if we were talking about the third-string quarterback on the Jaguars?
Well, yeah, I think it kind of has to be, right? I mean, that's why you have these things. I mean, if the third-string quarterback's doing it, that's not going to affect the game the same way, and it's not. I just tend to think that it has to be severe. I don't think it will be. The commissioner's a friend of the owner of the Patriots, Kraft. Tom Brady makes the NFL a lot of money, a lot of money. That will be very hard to, and that's one of the things that they probably consider as well, right? Even the high-profile nature of him doing it in the playoffs, they're also going to consider it's Tom freaking Brady.
Yeah, sure. Unfortunately, I think it would be pretty much the opposite, that if it were the third-string quarterback of the Jags, maybe the penalty would be more severe because the NFL's not going to lose any money.
Not
going to
care.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. It's a fair point. And so I do. I think it should be severe. I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine it's going to be more than two games. It really is. Two games in the NFL is a fairly big deal. Five games is almost a season. Or it's half a season in the NFL, or not quite, but
a third.
Yeah. It's a big deal in the NFL, five games.
Yeah, I gravitate towards that number thinking about the Roethlisberger suspension of a few years back. And that was obviously criminal activity.
Right.
When you come down somewhere between that and some of the incidents from last season, I think I come somewhere in around there.
What about you, Matt? Where do you go with it? What do you think? How many games?
I agree with you, Rusty. I think two games is kind of what I have in my head. I think there'll be a fine as well. But I think that 2 to 4 is probably the realistic range.
Yeah, you can't take away draft picks. You can't find the organization. And even though the fumbles feels like it to me that they coincide, I don't think that they can take that into account either. As much as they maybe should, that they can't really take that into account. And I just think, real quickly, and this is where you could maybe help a little, Matt, since you are a law-speaking guy. but, I mean, what the Brady camp is saying is you can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But in this case, that's for a criminal matter, right? This feels like more of a civil thing to me, where you're talking about the preponderance of the evidence,
right,
or the balance of probabilities. And that's the language they keep using.
It's true, because that's the standard for discipline in the NFL. It's based more on that civil standard. The reality, though, is that the NFL is not constrained by the Wells report. The Wells report was not something that was designed to reach a conclusion that would then automatically lead to a certain outcome. It was a fact-finding investigation that puts the commissioner in the league office in a position to be able to assess what they think would be the appropriate step forward. But they're not locked in to a certain path, and the collective bargaining agreement doesn't lock them into any kind of set range of penalties for this. I mean, I think there's a lot of discretion, but yeah, at the end of the day, we're talking about a private enterprise is complicated, but
sure.
The reality is that this is something that it's quite silly to be applying any kind of criminal standard to, because it's no different than suggesting that your employer should have to, beyond a reasonable doubt, know that you violated some workplace policy before they take some disciplinary action. That's just not how
work, not the way it works.
Yeah,
not
the
a
way
workplace.
It works. Yeah,
not, it just
I,
isn't.
Yeah, that did not strike me as a reasonable concern.
Oh, I don't think the Brady camp has been reasonable. I really don't. Just all the way around, that whole side just has not responded reasonably. From not handing over evidence when they were just trying to be the Wells report wasn't. It's like you're saying, it's not a binding report. The NFL doesn't want it to be binding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they really want to give Tom Brady the benefit of the doubt, I feel like. And Tom Brady instead is like, no, I'm taking my balls and going home. And so that's going to lead us, I think it's we agree Tom Brady is guilty of having deflated footballs. We don't know exactly what that means. Maybe it prevents fumbles. I imagine it has to. It's easier to hold a football if it's less inflated.
Sure.
But so in the context of other sports, though, and how we look at cheating in general, I think it's good to look at baseball and how cheating has been treated in baseball, because it's also very interesting how we've treated those people. We see Barry Bonds, and Matt, you brought up that Barry Bonds is reviled now, mm-hmm. is absolutely reviled as a player, and nobody thinks he belongs. I shouldn't say nobody, because I do. I think he belongs in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But most people do not think he belongs in the Hall of Fame. So, I mean, do you want to just let's address the conflict that goes on in baseball, where A-Rod is a heel right now, Pete Rose is loved, and everybody wants him back in the game. But what he did was far more detrimental to the integrity of the game than when everybody else is cheating by using performance-enhancing drugs, whether it be steroids or PhD or...
PED,
thanks. Thank you, PED, or as far as that goes, the amphetamines that were also, though not expressly forbidden like steroids, they weren't expressly forbidden by baseball, but it was illegal for you to get them without having a medical reason for mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that baseball, and it's not unique to PEDs, there are a lot of other areas where it creates issues, but I think that baseball and the Baseball Hall of Fame is kind of held captive still by a lot of like old white guys who think of mm-hmm. baseball as being, you know, the game of their youth, and they have a sort of sacrosanct view of, you know, the protecting the integrity of the game, which is so silly, because I mean, you go through the Hall of Fame and it's not, there's no morals clause to getting in the Hall of Fame.
No, obviously yeah. not.
There are some repulsive people in the Hall of Fame for reasons both related to their, you know, their on-field performance and their, you know, their off-field personalities. But the idea that, you know, we're supposed to draw some kind of line and take into account, and in many cases, it's not even evidence of PEDs, it's the perception, because for a lot of these guys they never failed a drug test, you know, and there's no direct or clear evidence that even if they were using PEDs that it meaningfully inflated their performance. I think there's actually been sort of some inconclusive studies of that, but Barry Bonds would have been a Hall of Famer even if he had just maintained the same level of production that he had for, you know, the first half of his career. He would have been a clear, no question, first ballot Hall of Famer. Roger Clemens, another guy, clear, no question, arguably the greatest pitcher ever. And now he very well may not make the Hall of Fame because some baseball writers think that it's icky that, you know, these guys were using PEDs.
Yeah, and for me, there's no good argument against identifying and evaluating strictly, when we're thinking about the Hall of Fame, era by era. Were you the best of your era, instead of comparing from one era to another? You know, when everyone was taking PEDs, who was the best that was taking PEDs?
right.
Yeah.
I think that's what matters, rather than who was the best that was versus a different era separated by 40 years where maybe they weren't, but they were doctoring baseballs. So that was a different era that had a competitive advantage in a different way. How can we compare those like they're two oranges?
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that, Tim. I think that you're right on with that. I mean, we should be looking at how the eras work. With baseball, there is the tendency, because you've got Babe Ruth's home run total or now Barry Bonds' home run total, that we want to compare era to era. Yeah. But it never works that way. Nobody was working out the way that people are working out now. They didn't
right.
have video to study how pitchers pitched. They didn't have all the science behind it. I heard one of the coolest things, and this is off topic, but I heard one of the coolest things about how batters are thrown off. If you can get a pitch within 12 seconds of the last pitch and you can vary either the speed or the location, it's hard for a batter's brain to pick that up. Hmm. They didn't know that in Babe Ruth's time.
Right.
They weren't looking at that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, we are now. And so you can't compare them really fairly. There's no fair comparison to it, aside from just the numbers alone.
And to me, what it comes down to is that I just don't know who's supposed to be the arbiter of first of all determining who was in fact using PEDs, because for a lot of these guys that are on the outside looking in, again, they never failed a drug test. They've never been convicted of anything. You can certainly – there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. But I don't have confidence that every baseball writer who's voting for the Baseball Hall of Fame has taken upon themselves for every Hall of Fame eligible player to review, you know, their entire medical history and every association they've ever had with a questionable doctor. So I think that, first of all, it's just an impossible mission to ever be able to sort out who was using and who wasn't. But beyond that, I think Tim's right on the money that, you know, the only way to meaningfully compare how successful someone was to compare them to their peers, to the era they performed in. And by that measure, you know, there's no question that even if there was rampant PED use and Hall of Fames were going through the roof, that Barry Bonds was still the arguably the most dominant offensive player, not only of his era, but of any era when you view his production relative to his peers during his peak. I mean, his on-base percentage as a result of his walk rate is unbelievable. I mean, the fear factor that he was able to create. And the Hall of Fame, I think, is supposed to be a place that captures the entire scope of the history of the game. And to carve out a 10-year period where some of the most hallowed records in baseball history were set and just decide we're going to ignore that from the Hall of Fame, It seems crazy.
Well, and it devalues the Hall a little bit when you've got Craig Biggio, whom I like. I like Craig Biggio. I think he's a really neat player.
Yeah.
But you've got him in and you don't have Barry Bonds. That just doesn't make sense. That doesn't jive in any sense of the way. And people are clamoring for Pete Rose to come into the Hall of Fame, and they really want that. But I again go, I was a big Pete Rose fan growing up. I was at the game where he tied the record for hits.
Wow.
For 4,191 hits. He had 3 hits to go, and we drove to Chicago like mad demons, my family and I, to go see this game. And we were 2 innings late, but we ended up with amazing seats in the 9th row, like behind the Cubs on deck circle. Oh, it was incredible. Harry Carey waved to us. It was the stuff of dreams and magic.
Yeah.
And Pete Rose tied the record for hits, and the game was called on account of darkness because there were no lights at Wrigley Field.
Wow.
So it was so cool, you know. It was just like this amazing moment that I hold in my childhood. But him cheating on baseball and the time that it happened, and betting on baseball, I should say. I mean, even though he didn't bet against the teams, his lying, he was a chronic liar through the end of that tenure of his time. And the way he treated the people around him and the way he treated, even though it was found betting slips with his fingerprints and stuff, he's still framed. I mean, he takes the Tom Brady approach. Nope, can't be me. I'll have my dad write a letter.
Right.
And so that's just where, to me, I don't like Pete Rose as much as I like Barry Bonds. You know, I feel like he did more. He was wearing his pitcher's arms out in games, you know, having them warm up when they weren't going to be needed. There are a lot of ways that he hurt the game and the integrity of the game. And I just, to me, it's interesting that we're willing to forgive Pete Rose. We're willing to forgive, say, Cal Ripken for being on amphetamines, but not Barry Bonds. And like you said, there's no test. We can't go back and test all these people.
Sure.
It's just conjecture. Pure conjecture by these white guys. And
yeah.
And not only that, I want to say one other thing too, is these guys who took these PEDs, they are the ultra most competitive people. Yeah. And these are jobs anybody, most young men in their 20s would give practically anything to have these jobs. Mm-hmm. Absolutely anything. And to think that you wouldn't take amphetamines or you wouldn't take steroids when everybody else is, when the whole set of competition is set up with those,
right,
that you wouldn't do it is just, it blows me away that anybody can argue that.
Yeah. And especially because a lot of the drugs that are in question weren't even expressly banned at the time that some of these guys were using them or at least started using them. So, Rusty, I think you're right. I think that if anybody really puts themselves in the shoes of those players, that it's hard to really suggest that you wouldn't make the same choice that a lot of them made.
Tim, do you want to have the last word here on anything you want to add?
No, I think for me the big walk away is that, like I said, with comparing, you know, era to era, that there's no reason except for the nostalgia of the most influential voices right now that you can really make a good argument that were okay with entering into the Hall of Fame who was the best at doctoring a baseball, essentially, but were not okay with who was best at hitting in the PED era.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Gaylord Perry, 300-game winner in the Hall of Fame, openly bragged about it. Yet we all joke, and good old Gaylord Perry, that's just his way. You know, and yeah, he hit it, and he had Vaseline all over his hat and in his pockets, and that we're willing to laugh that off somehow.
And I would suggest that that's probably something that has a more direct effect on the game itself and on performance than the, you know, potentially marginal effect that being stronger has, because there's so much more to hitting a baseball than just being really strong. So
that's true. That's true. It's listed as the hardest thing. Hitting a home run in baseball is listed as the hardest thing to do in professional sports, even over a hole in one in golf.
I have a question when we wrap this segment up, or while we wrap it up. How many swings would it take you to hit a home run in a major league park? We'll say 70 mile an hour pitches right down the middle of the plate.
I don't think I ever would.
You have a lifetime. You have, from now until you die, do you think you could ever
well,
do it?
Well, if I set my lifetime to doing it, right, and I practiced every day. You know, everybody jokes that Michael Jordan was terrible at baseball, but that 30 for 30 on ESPN kind of shows that towards the end he was getting better because he was such a great athlete. I'm not a great athlete. I don't know that I'll get better. Maybe I squeak one out after 30 years of doing it, but I don't know. It's hard to imagine. Tim, do you think you hit any home runs?
No, I think I would fall somewhere in the same range, you know, maybe after around 30 years I got lucky enough that I made that contact right. But when I go to the batting cages, I know that there's just a certain level of hand-eye coordination that isn't there.
And, you know, that leads us to our next segment, because hand-eye coordination is what it's about. We're going to talk to you about video games and sports in video games on Can't Wait.